This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon, I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have in studio Portage Police Chief Troy Williams as we continue our conversation about the concern that crimes that are committed in Illinois might spill over into Northwest Indiana and what is being done about it if it is indeed happening. We'll also talk with Jessica Renslow from the Miller neighborhood to find out more about how a recreational tourism festival will attract residents to that area, being called the Outdoor Adaptive Escapade, one of many programs that the organization sets up in the Miller neighborhood. And we'll also talk to you with Robert Tabor with the nonprofit American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation. Their special Rail Rangers guides are going to be riding the rails on the South Shore Line next month. That and more coming up after the news. We started this conversation not long ago with talking with Dan Merchek with the Lake County Sheriff's Department about the concerns that crimes that happen in Illinois can affect us here in Northwest Indiana. That's only because there's just that thin line, imaginary line, if you want to call it that, the state line between the two states, and the fact that, we have such a tightly compacted urban area. And one of the concerns, things we talked about, not only is the concern about crimes that happen spilling over into Northwest Indiana, but what can be done about it if there is anything that can be done. And in our conversation with Dan Merchek, we're continuing it on now. We have in studio to talk about it Portage Police Chief Troy Williams. Chief Williams, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's take up this question first, the concern that it's been brought up, and we mentioned in our first conversation about, I guess for some it may be a fear, certainly a concern, and that would be a concern not only among citizens but also with the law enforcement community about crimes that happen in Illinois that somehow or another can end up over, or at least have an impact over here in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. The Northwest Indiana region has a lot of vibrant, growing communities. So, unfortunately, you do see some traffic from Illinois that come over here that want to commit some crime. We've come across a few Illinois theft rings and fraudulent check writers. One of the things that we try to do is educate our public. So we're speaking, our department is speaking at the Chamber of Commerce breakfast on Thursday, and we'll be meeting with the seniors in town at the Bonner Center, hopefully here in a few weeks. The other thing we try to do is share information with other departments. There is a monthly detective meeting that in both Lake and Porter County that the detectives go to and share the information and the crimes that are happening, so we can kind of stay on top of what's going on, what the trends are.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you should mention about the fact that we, of course, always think about the violent crimes, the murders and such that happen, that could happen and come over here. And we know about, of course, on the federal level, what the gangs have done, the establishment that they've had over the years. And we know very much that the former U.S. Attorney David Capp had worked very hard, and his successor is also working very hard in trying to deal with the gangs that have come over and
Definitely.
Established themselves. So we talk about the violent crimes, but it's interesting you mentioned things about thefts and things like that. Do we find, if it does happen, if the spillage does come over, that it's more of these nonviolent crimes, but still just the same, affect residents?
Yeah, any type of crime affects a resident. Obviously, depending on the severity of the crime, how much it may affect them. I mean, if you talk to most chiefs or sheriffs around the region, I think they will tell you most of the crime revolves around substance abuse, illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. A lot of the theft fuels, addicts steal so they can get money to buy their drugs. So again, collectively as a region, we want to be working together to share information, to share trends. If you've got some information about, burglaries in your town, does that translate to what we have in our town? And are they the same suspects? And oftentimes we find out that they are. Mm-hmm. So crime, we know, doesn't stand still. It's not one place. It's going to go around wherever they can find the weakest point, and so we all got to be working together.
You mentioned the narcotics issue. We're finding, unfortunately, too, that our opioid crisis is a part of that gets fueled because of the opportunity, of the need for the drugs to come over?
Absolutely. The availability of illegal substances, illegal drugs, unfortunately, is on the rise. Prescription pills, one man's opinion, I think, as society, we're probably overprescribed, and it makes it easy to access, especially our kids in school. We have really good SROs that work with the schools to try to combat that. Another thing that we do at the Portage Police Department is to help eliminate some of the theft concerns or being taken advantage of. We've offered our lobby and our parking lot, because they're both video recorded, as a safe trade station.
Oh.
So somebody wants to come in there and do their, online exchange that they purchase something, they can come to our station and do it. It can be a meeting point. If you're coming from Fort Wayne and from Chicago, feel free to use our station.
Great. We've talked in the past about organizations that help deal with the rise in crime in general, as well as the crime that may come over from Illinois into Northwest Indiana. And we know that the Northwest Indiana Major Crimes Task Force is very much involved in that. They're more of a reactive agency, though, aren't they? They're looking to find ways to help maybe reduce crime, but they're more concerned about investigating the ones that happen.
That's correct. We have detectives assigned to that task force as well. Again, it's important to work together, share information. If a crime were to happen and a particular community would like to activate them, then they would call the task force commander and do that. Jumping back to the opioid thing you mentioned, we at our department added a third officer to the Porter County Multi-Enforcement Group that goes after the illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. So it was important that we're committing as much as our resources as we can afford to do.
So you're doing what you can, at least on a short-term basis, to do proactive work to be able to find ways to reduce, if not eliminate, the crime.
Yes. Well, short-term and long-term. I took over in 2012, and one of the messages is like, we're not going to tolerate the drug dealers, the gangbangers, and major acts of violence. So when we took over, our SWAT team was one of our focuses, and in the first year, we had like 22 activations. The second year was 20, and now last year in 2016, it was probably 4, and this year I think we've had 1. So I think that goes to show where we had four consecutive year drop in crime, a slight rise in 2016, but we were down many, many officers. But still yet the third lowest total in the last 20-some years. Just continuing to stay on top of that, educating the public, being transparent as a department, so that, our community trusts us and they know they can come to us if they had a question or concern.
We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams as we continue our conversation into the spillage of crime, major and minor, if you want to refer to it as such, that comes from Illinois over into Northwest Indiana. And one of the concerns I know, Chief, is that you want to be sure that you build a good relationship with the community, and police officers work very hard at that. We know in the urban communities it's more difficult, but what do you feel that, at least what you try within your role there as the Portage Police Chief to help strengthen that relationship?
I think we're pretty fortunate. We have a lot of our officers, they live in Portage, they grew up there, they're obviously raising their families, so when their kids get involved in like different youth organizations or sports teams, they see these officers at different events. We do host a Citizens Academy and a Youth Explorers program, so that's another way to outreach with the community. We just recently, back in October of 2016, moved into a new police department building. It's the former University Center downtown. Mm-hmm. So that allows us – it's not your typical police department. It's not kind of – it's not drab. It's not walled off or anything. It's very open and inviting, and I think that's important when you're walking into a police department. So we have also National Night Out coming August 1st down at Founders Square, and most communities police departments do that around the country, and so we'll be bringing out all our specialty equipment, our canines, SWAT team, to let the citizens and the kids and everybody come take a look at it.
You talk about being a close part of the Portage community and trying to not only tell people that you're there if they need the assistance, but also, too, to show that you're part of the community. You're as much a resident of Portage as they are. And do you get any good response from residents when you have these opportunities to get together?
It's funny you say that. I just got a card in the mail today, actually, mm-hmm. from a resident who just wanted to thank us for the job that we do. She's like, as a woman, I've lived here many, many years. I just wanted to reach out and let you all know that you do a great job here if no one's telling you. And, we get complimented pretty regularly, and we're pretty, you know, happy with that. And that doesn't mean we can't make a mistake, you know, along the way. And if we do, then we want to correct those things. We don't want to rest on our laurels, and we want to try to, you know, continue to build on the relationships that we have. And again, let the community know we're there to help them.
I know it may not be the case necessarily in the city of Portage, but in other communities here in Northwest Indiana, the relationship is still strained between police officers and the public. Some of it is because of years of distrust, and it can happen. And it's difficult to be able to change those ways. I know it has come up like that. Is there anything in particular that you and your officers work on to help try and strengthen, certainly between strengthening that bond between community and the police departments, but also just as citizens?
Sure. I would agree with you. I think there is, you know, somewhat of a national movement that, different areas of the country maybe not necessarily happy with some of the, police involvement that they've had. I think as you see, as things bear out, the police have been found to be justified in some of the things. However, we want as a community to be transparent, and so we, have these programs, again, the Citizens Academy, Youth Explorers, and those types of things. One of the things that we do, I think we're very successful with, is our social media outreach. Our Facebook page has nearly 17,000 likes on it, and when we get a video or a picture of a suspect from a crime, we will put it on there, and I'll bet you our solve rate is 95% from the public. And usually within the first day, it's that crime is solved. So that lets the residents know, hey, we're actively trying to, work for you to get this issue solved, but we can't do it alone. We need your eyes and ears, and we've been very successful at that.
Does it seem that, certainly in this case in particular, I'll be using the Facebook page to get the information out about crimes and about people that are wanted in connection with the crimes, that people are more apt to participate that way? It's anonymous, but you're not completely anonymous.
You can't be anonymous because they can send us a private message, so they don't necessarily have to post something, in the public commentary. But it allows them to remain private. We do allow, commentary on there. I think that's important. We try to answer, questions as they come up. And now we may not always agree on something, but it allows our community to voice their concerns or their opinions, and us to, understand how they're feeling. And I think if we, continue to do that, we can only get better together.
Now, we've talked here, in fact, at the start of our conversation, about some of the activities coming up here that the Portage Police Department is working to get more people involved in the community with the department and help out. Is there anything in particular that you, in talking with Mayor Snyder and other people in the city council, that you would like to do with the police department to be able to strengthen that tie a little better?
We're always looking for new and innovative ideas to reach out to the community. I said an annual one, which we have coming up, is the National Night Out. Mm-hmm. So we will have a big display out that night. I know the Porter County Fair is around the corner. We'll probably have some officers out there, maybe some of our specialty equipment. Especially, kids like those things. We encourage our officers, although the school's out, school gets back into session, to go read at the schools. A lot of times we get invited to do that. So anytime we can have a positive interaction with the community, we want to do that.
Do you think that these efforts have helped kind of keep the crime spillage from getting as far to the east as Portage?
I think so. I mean, I challenge a community to say that they have no crime. I mean, so it's how you're going to address it. And I think if you do it proactively, but in conjunction with your community, then you're both going to win. Like I said, we've been fortunate. We had a four-year drop that never happened, four consecutive year that had never happened before. Slight rise this last year, but still at the third lowest ever. So that tells me that we and the community are doing something right.
Portage Police Chief Troy Williams with us to continue our conversation about the concern about crime spillage from Illinois that makes its way across the state line into Northwest Indiana. Chief Williams, thanks for taking time to be with us today for this conversation, and I hope to have you back again soon, and we'll continue the conversation along talking with other law enforcement officials here in Northwest Indiana.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Miller neighborhood in the city of Gary is inviting visitors to paddle, bike, shoot bows and arrows, and a lot of other activities as well. A very special festival that is coming up on July 15th. It's called the Outdoor Adaptive Escapade. It's a mouthful right there, and coming out of the Miller Spotlight program. And to talk more about it, we have Jessica Renslow, who's a Miller Spotlight community builder. Jessica, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Well,
first, tell us a little bit, for people that are not familiar with what the organization is all about, how did the Community Spotlight in the community of Miller get started, and who supports it?
Oh, well, we are sponsored through Legacy Foundation, and our backbone organization is the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. We were chosen in 2015 from 18 different communities to pilot the program. Miller and Northwest Hobart were the pilot communities, and then in 2016, downtown Emerson and Gary got it, and Griffith did as well, the whole entire city of Griffith. So we've been working since then, doing the community plan. Well, that's where the community actually chooses goals and makes a plan around it, and then we've been implementing them, so this is part of that.
Well, so I want to get back to that point here about the community plan here, if we can, before we finish up here. But let's talk a little bit here about this very first annual Outdoor Adaptive Escapade that's going to be planned. Where is it going to be held? When's it going to be held? And how can folks take advantage of it?
Well, it's happening this Saturday, July 15th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Gary's beautiful Miller community. And the first part, 10 to noon, will be at 6300 Miller Avenue, 46403, and it's actually the old Ralph or Wilco, depending on your age, grocery store, which we've been transforming into a community hub from an abandoned, blighted grocery store. So we fought the blight, now we're making it into an active place for community health projects and play and recreation. And in the second half, we're going to take a little bit of time, an hour off, so everybody can go set up at the beach and everybody can get down there. And then we'll have vendors at Marquette Beach and Lake Street Beach. And we'll have three separate bike rides, adaptive bike rides, going across our trails.
I was looking at the information here before we have our conversation today, and it talks about a number of activities, recreational activities, that maybe, besides, of course, the beach, can't miss the beach. It's so prominent in the community of Miller, but there are a lot of other things that people probably are not aware of that is available there in the Miller neighborhood. Tell us about those.
Yeah, oh, we've got a lot going on. I mean, beach adjacent is our ADA-compliant kayak launch, which just happens to be universally designed and good for everyone. And then we have several different art institutions, and we've got little local businesses. It's really cute and up-and-coming neighborhood. So.
That's what I understand, that the arts neighborhood in particular has really grown over the last few years here, and we've seen a lot more new businesses that have come into Miller, and I know there's a lot of efforts to help support those new businesses as well as the existing ones in the community. And you talk about the activities that you can take advantage of here this weekend for this very special outdoor adaptive escapade, and the regular activities as well too that kind of emphasize not only the neighborhood itself, but also the fact that it's such an outdoorsy type place. What other activities are there in Miller that folks, besides what they can take advantage of this weekend, just go to any day if they like?
Oh, well, we have an incredibly rare echo system, and so the Douglas Center is a great, great resource and a wonderful community partner of ours. They lead hikes on a regular basis, and they've got an education focus, so they've got a lot of stuff for young families, free yoga, nature things. They do bonfires at the beach once a month usually. I mean, it's just wonderful what they do for us. And then in the actual, like, downtown city, there's actually the Preserve Gary tours happening on the same day. Our garden club is doing their garden walk. It's all this wonderful, really busy day in Gary, Indiana. So we're hoping that there'll be some cross-pollination between the different events and people just realize, oh, there's lots to do actually in the city. So
I know that obviously that the Gary Air Show has been a big part, of course, of Gary there at Marquette Park. And unfortunately, because there's not going to be an air show this year, it's probably giving you a chance to be able to explore on some of these other activities that still bring folks into the Miller neighborhood as well, but take advantage of the park as well as the residents that live nearby. Do you think that all of this together, you mentioned here, a lot of it is, what has come about in the community plan, is the things that were set forth some time ago, and you're getting to put these together on and make them available on a regular basis? Or are you planning new things that are going to, it's not only in the plan, but are going to come in the future too? We're talking with Jessica Renslow, who is a Miller Spotlight community builder, about the upcoming, in fact, it's this coming Saturday, July 15th, Outdoor Adaptive Escapade. It's going to happen in the Miller neighborhood. You'll find activities all around the community itself, as well as along Miller Beach and the Lake Street Beach. And all these activities, of course, part of the activities that the Miller Spotlight organization put puts together. It's one of two community spotlights supported by the Legacy Foundation, and the turn is supervised by the Miller Arts and Creative District. And Jessica, when you talk about the overall community plan that was set up some time ago, what did residents at the time they created this plan really want to do, and how did they want to be involved themselves? It's an opportunity to be involved in the community.
Well, everyone really at first, when you create a community plan, it seems like a all-encompassing beast. But once you work it together and get actually attainable goals, what really came out was, you know, we had seven basic themes that most communities want, you know, good schools, safe environment, capitalizing on tourism, a steady economy, you know, good infrastructure. So this is stuff that comes up normally in most communities. And so as a volunteer group, though, it's how, what can we do and what spots can we actually do projects, and when can we just need to be actual advocates. So we've been doing a lot of both, actually. Mm-hmm. And the great thing that's happened from that is a lot of different entities and governing bodies have definitely been able to back us up. So it's been great. Overarching mm-hmm. goal is to actually push for being a livable community, an age-friendly community.
I was going to ask, how much help do you get from Gary City Hall on a lot of the projects that you like to, that you have done and you would like to do?
We have definitely, over the years, when we first did the community plan, it was very grassrootsy, but that was kind of intentional to have the community choose the goals. And since then, we've worked with them on a couple of projects. So the site that we're actually hosting as the main hub for the Outdoor Adaptive Escapade is actually a redevelopment property. And so they worked with us to help us get a budget to actually help fix it up. And then we hired local artists to do it. And then we've had over 200 volunteers working on it. So it's been a really good combined effort between community volunteers and the city's redevelopment project, so it's been kind of good.
That's great. You talk about volunteers. It's always the key to keeping projects like these alive. And how can people get involved if they'd like to be involved in the Miller Spotlight projects and the like? How can they, first off, learn about them and how they can show their support as being a volunteer?
Well, they can definitely follow us on Facebook at Miller Spotlight, or they can check out our blog, blogspot.millerspotlight.com. And they can also email me directly at millerspotlight@gmail.com, or they can give me a call at 818-294-4240.
We're talking with Jessica Renslow, who is a Miller Spotlight community builder. And, of course, the Miller Spotlight, one of the two community spotlights established back in 2014 in Northwest Indiana, supported by the Legacy Foundation. And those number of spotlights are growing all the time. And it's all, of course, to help revitalize the Miller neighborhood in Gary and involve residents as well and citizens and businesses in grassroots community development. Jessica, thank you for taking time to talk about this weekend's big event. Hope it turns out to be a real success.
Thank you so much for having me.
Passengers who travel on the South Shore line between downtown Chicago and South Bend, including the stops here in Northwest Indiana, will have a real treat this summer and fall. There'll be some special people on board the trains. It's part of the nonprofit American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation project that offers docents to talk with people on the train, talking a little history and some other interesting facts as well, too, as they travel the rails. With us to talk about it, we have Robert Tabern, for the organization. Thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking, Robert.
Hey, thanks for having us, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the foundation does, and in particular, the organization that are called Rail Rangers Guides, with the people that are actually going to be on the South Shore line starting in here in August.
Yeah, we're part of a 501c3 nonprofit. We're actually based out in Missouri, but most of our guides are from the Chicagoland area. We're a nonprofit that started about 10 years ago with a exhibition of Amtrak history out in Missouri, and then there's a railroad overlook out in Missouri as well. So kind of a rail-themed town in La Plata, which is near Kirksville, Missouri. If you're ever up in northeast Missouri, that's where our headquarters are, some mm-hmm. of our venues. But a few years ago, we decided to expand out from just the focus of northeast Missouri to include kind of the seven-state region around the Midwest. And part of that was the formation of the Rail Rangers program, which are basically docents or interpretive guides who ride on the train and tell passengers what they see outside their window.
I was taking a look at the information that you folks had sent on from the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, and these docents have been very popular, and you've had great success, I understand, in the last 3 years or so with a lot of people that have learned a lot on these rails and trails talks that you set up, I guess, first with Amtrak. And I understand, too, you even took advantage of some of the Hoosier State Line between Chicago and at least Lafayette as it makes its way to Indianapolis back in the days when the Iowa Pacific people were running the train.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris. Our group, our docents all have 5 or more years experience of presenting these programs, so that's something we're very excited about. Trails and Rails started out of Chicago in 2000, so it's mm-hmm. been 17 years. They were on several different lines, including the Southwest Chief to La Plata and down to St. Louis up to Minnesota. And we decided to form our own organization, the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation, in July of 2015. We're just rolling around with our 2-year anniversary. We mostly do private rail cars on various lines all across the Midwest. And then we decided to do a public rail trip, and we partnered with Iowa Pacific around this time last year and did several months on the Hoosier State between Lafayette and Chicago, did several months of programs. And when that ended, the Iowa Pacific ownership of the services ended at the end of February. We approached the South Shore Line and NICTD. They were very open and very excited about having the possibility of continuing those public programs on their trains between Chicago and South Bend.
When you got started with this series, what communities and topics were the ones that that seemed to bring the most interest, and in turn you decided to expand from that point?
Well, the South Shore Line is a great line. Hopefully everybody has a chance to ride on it or has taken a ride on it already. It goes from Chicago all the way to South Bend through many northwest Indiana communities like East Chicago. There's several stops in Gary, the Miller neighborhood, all the way over to Michigan City, Beverly Shores, Chesterton, all in there. So there's a lot of interesting stories along the route to share with people. You go actually through 4 different units of the National Park Service as you through or near 4 units of the National Park Service between Chicago and South Bend, including I&M Canal, Pullman National Monument, the Indiana Dunes, National Lakeshore, which a lot of people are familiar with, I'm sure, and then the new Kankakee River National Water Trail. So it's quite an interesting route. I can't think of any other train line anywhere in the Midwest that goes near or through 4 units of the National Park Service.
Now, what kind of logistics are you going through working with NICTI, which is the organization that, of course, owns and runs the South Shore Line, to get things all set up so that they'll have guests on board the trains in addition to the regular passengers?
Yeah, we decided, they've been great to work with, and we decided to do these programs on a select Saturday morning and early afternoon departures in talking with the folks at the railroad, the South Shore Line and ICTD. We decided that, you know, this is probably not for your average commuter who's commuting every day back and forth between Northwest Indiana and Chicago or the South Bend area or Michigan City. We decided to focus on families and also the recreational travelers. There's a lot of stops in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore that people can take the train out to. So we're kind of aiming at families. We have a junior ranger program that children can participate in, and also the occasional commuter to get them to see, hey, maybe this is a great way instead of driving, fighting the traffic on the south side of Chicago or the Skyway. This is a great way to get over to see our national park.
Now, you've had a chance to take a look at the schedule and try and pick the days, the select Saturdays that you want to have the guides out there talking with people. Give us the list that you have right now, and are you liable to be able to, if the opportunities present themselves, to add to the list?
Yeah, we decided to start as a test program. We're going to be on through the end of January 2018, so we're going to do this for about 6 months. And then we hope, you know, everybody enjoys it and gets good feedback. We hope that we're able to expand it, become a permanent feature on the train. Our very first program will be on August 5th, and then we'll be doing it several other dates, 2 in August, 2 in September, and 2 in October. And then probably through the holiday season, we'll have our complete schedule up on our website, which is dunes.com, or you can check us out on South Shoreline, all one word, .org, and then just click on upcoming trips. Our first big trip, though, is on August the 5th.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that basically you're going to start out from Millennium Station in Chicago with the train from there, and you'll make the eastbound route, and then with a little layover, then you'll go from South Bend to the airport station there and then head back west again. Is the plan just basically to do maybe like one trek, or are you going to make more than than more than one round trip, so to speak.
Well, that's exactly it, Chris. We're going to be going from Chicago, because that's where most of our guides live and are based in the Chicagoland area, all the way to South Bend. We leave Chicago about 8:40 in the morning, get to South Bend about 10, 12 Eastern time, have a little bit of a layover, then work our way back with the 1:10 p.m. Eastern time train on Saturdays, getting back to Chicago just before 3 o'clock. The nice thing is folks don't have to ride the entire route with us if they don't want to. Of course, they're more than welcome to, but, you know, you could ride just from Chicago to Gary, or maybe go, you know, spend some time in the dunes, or you could ride Chicago to Michigan City or ride back. And there's plenty of other options, the trains that won't have guides on them, so you could listen to us one way, maybe spend some time in South Bend or the dunes, and then ride back home on your own schedule of some of the other departures. So we'll just be on that one round trip. It's about six-hour round trip for us.
Well, that's a great opportunity that if you happen to miss that particular day, starting out, as you say, on August 5th, you've got another trek that's going to be out around August 26th, and so you can make a plan, and if you know when the schedule is going to be, that the Rail Rangers are going to be out there, you can make that trip if you want to, and be sure to catch them if you can't happen to be there, making that one day. That works out very nicely. Now, once again, if anyone's interested in finding out more about when the guides are going to be out there, when the Rail Rangers guides are going to be available to talk to people on the trains on the South Shore on these selected Saturdays, where can they find the information now?
Definitely. Check out our websites, Dunes, plural, Dunes Train, that's all one word, .com, or South Shoreline, all one word, .org. Or also give us a like on Facebook. We have a Facebook page up for the APRHF Rail Rangers, and we post all our dates and schedules all on there.
Robert Taborn is the vice president of the American Passenger Rail Heritage Foundation. They're the organization that is setting up the summertime into the autumn months Rail Rangers Guide trips on the South Shore Line, running, of course, through Northwest Indiana. Robert, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate the information, and we're looking forward to the opportunities to catch up with you on the train when you're here in the region.
Well, thanks, Chris, and I hope to see all your listeners very soon on the South Shore Line.
Indiana legislators have hotly debated the state's alcohol laws for years, most recently discussing cold beer and carryout sales. But before alcohol can even be sold, a permit or license must be obtained. The process isn't easy, and some are calling for a change in the process. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, it's unclear what that change should be.
A historic theater in downtown Bloomington is getting a serious makeover. Right now, during the demolition stage, piles of wood are being taken in and out. There are tools on the floor, sawdust everywhere.
After you just take a couple steps, you'll obviously be able to look up all the way straight up to 25-foot ceilings.
That's Logan Hunter. He plans to open an upscale rustic bar and restaurant called Alchemy in the Princess Theater. Hunter scouted locations for his bar for more than 4 years before locking in this location. He's faced one challenge after the next in need of fixing, with plumbing, flooding, and mold, for example. But another necessity on his list? An alcohol permit.
Like, at this point, automatically just, you know, it's a dead end. There are none available.
That's because whether certain types of permits are available or not through the Alcohol and Tobacco Commission depends on where you're at. It's based off a quota system determined by the size of a town or city's population. Heather Lynch is the media relations officer with the Indiana State Excise Police. She says it's not her job to make the rules, but that the quota system does make sense.
If there was not a quota system, then you could have an entire street that is, you know, nothing but alcoholic beverage establishments, and then the next street over, and then the next street over.
There are more than 50 different types of permits for selling alcohol, and there are different ways to get the one you need.
The hottest commodity, so to speak, would be a three-way license with carryout. So someone who wanted to have beer, wine, and liquor, and then also be able to sell for carryout.
Here are the options for buying a permit. You can buy an existing one from the Alcohol and Tobacco Commission at a fixed price. A three-way license, for example, is $1,000. But that's only if one is available, which is rare. New ones can be added when a census is done and the population grows. You can also buy a permit from a current owner of one or bid on one at an ATC auction. That happens when people don't renew their permits. Here's Hunter again.
Some people actually need them for existing establishments or establishments that they're planning on building. Other people don't need them and already are running establishments, and they bid on them and buy them so they can then scalp them. if you will, later.
That's right. The seller picks their selling price. And Hunter says from his experience, negotiations for a permit can start around $200,000. That's a huge expense for a new business owner like Hunter. And Democratic State Representative Terry Austin says possibly an unintended consequence when lawmakers designed the rules.
Well, the quota system, when it was passed, was actually a great idea to say, let's put some safeguards around alcohol access. But as demographics have changed, as development has changed, economic development has changed drastically.
Legislative leaders this year announced a 2-year study into the state's alcohol statutes. Some lawmakers called for a comprehensive overhaul of alcohol laws after controversy erupted when Ricker's convenience store legally began selling cold beer through a loophole. Austin says she doesn't want to predict future changes to the laws, but she thinks everything is on the table for discussion, including permit processes.
We know that, I mean, if we're going to be responsive to the public, we've got to take a look at everything, and we're going to have to find a way to make it work, one, both from a safety and access standpoint, but also from changing consumer norms.
Hunter says he understands reforming the alcohol permitting process is a slippery slope, but something has to change.
Having no licenses available just causes headaches and frustration, and it also ends up meaning that you're going to lose out on a lot of things that could bolster the economy in Monroe County.
Hunter is moving forward with renovations of his bar, which he plans to open sometime in the fall. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Work is wrapping up on the construction and remodeling at Community Hospital in Munster for the new surgical center. Dr. Richard Berkowitz and John Olmsted joined us recently to talk about the goals and the objectives behind the $20 million project and how it fits into Northwest Indiana's overall healthcare picture. And here's the conversation.
The segue for the surgical department or the perioperative services department for us was the initial building of the Parkview Tower, which houses a lot of the mother-baby medical care along with some other telemetry units. And so what that allowed us to do was to move into space previously occupied by them that made the entire perioperative service area better for both patients and the surgeons who operate here.
Okay. Mr. Olmsted, when you take a look at the overall operation, what in particular stands out to you, to, of course, your colleagues, the doctors and nurses and the other staff here at Community Hospital, that in turn will make it possibly more interesting, maybe more attractive to other doctors outside of the system, as well as to patients or potential patients?
If I had to summarize over the past several years, what are the real focus of our hospital is just to more embrace becoming an acute care hospital. We've always been deeply involved in acute care surgery, acute care services, and this expansion just adds to that. So we were able to build this new patient tower, expand a nursery, which Dr. Berkowitz can talk about because that certainly is in his field, and our labor and delivery areas, to expand services there, but also opening up that space allowed us to expand our surgical department to, again, increase all the acute care surgery that we do here at Community Hospital. It's funny, you know, when it comes to surgery, minor surgery is what happens to the other guy. So not to minimize any surgery, but certainly we do. There's really not a whole lot we don't do here at Community except for transplants. We do a lot of cardiac surgery, a lot of spine surgery, a lot of neurosurgery, general surgery. And this just allows us more space and technology to continue that mission.
I was thinking that probably that the upgrades that have been made here at Community Hospital kind of lead on to the fact that you can do more surgery, that maybe you think maybe someday, if things go well, that maybe that the transplants might not be out of the reach for the hospital, especially with all of the new improvements and developments that have happened for the surgical center here.
I think that not knowing what the future of medicine holds, I think that there are so many factors involved in trying to do transplant medicine that a lot of times that type of surgery is left better to the university programs where they truly are able to establish a multidisciplinary approach to the specifics.
But you're able to do some more things, I'm sure, now with the new facility here at the hospital that even before that you could do, and probably you feel more comfortable and more confident that you can do a better job, I would imagine.
Right. We you know, one of the programs, the most recent program we started was minimally invasive valve surgery that we collaborated with the cardiologists and the surgeons and nursing to be able to offer patients the ability to get valves replaced without having to go through a major 4 to 5 hour surgical operation.
Take us through the new and improved surgical center that's going to be finished up here in the end of April for not only doctors and staff here at the hospital, but the patients can experience as well. To tell us about what the facility is going to be like or is like, even now as the sections that are open, and what people can coming into the hospital can expect.
So one of the issues that we were faced with initially was patient flow. Okay, so our patients would start out, our same day as surgical patients would start out in another part of the hospital, not adjacent to the operating rooms. And so what we were able to do when the mother-baby medical care moved to the other tower was establish our same day surgical admission unit on the same floor, just adjacent to the operating rooms. And so it allows for the patients to get admitted to very nice rooms in the morning. Okay, where they wait for their surgeon, their anesthesiologist, they get admitted for their surgical care, and then that flow is all on the same floor. They don't have to be taken, they go right from that room into the operating room. They no longer have to be transported to a holding room and then into the surgical area. So the patients and the families like that approach much better than they did the old approach, which was having to be, I think it was John, they were moved almost two blocks from, you know, when you really calculate the distance.
It seemed like way. I imagine it doesn't matter. It could have been across the city for all you know.
Right. So it was really inconvenient, I think. And now it's a much better experience for them. We've constructed new operating rooms. So we made 4 additional operating rooms during this construction process. We established what we call the hybrid OR, which I alluded to earlier with our valve program, minimally invasive valve replacement program. The TAVR program. And then we are now starting to do some more construction in rehabbing some old operating rooms because these operating rooms were created, some of them in the early 70s. And we just need to refurbish them with modern technology as well as just refurbish them in general.
Okay. Since you've talked about what the convenience will be and probably comfort, psychological if not physical comfort for the patients too, that they won't have to They have this even flow from coming into the door, so to speak, to going into the emergency or going into the operating room. They will be able to feel better. I'm sure they'll probably maybe recover a little better. A lot of stress, I suppose, on them too. What do the family members seem to feel about the new facilities, or what they will feel when everything is all up and running, so to speak?
Oh, I can tell you, there's 2 aspects to that. One, it's always nice to have a new area. And you know, here at Community, when they rebuild things here, I mean, it looks amazing. I mean, it's just beautiful. But that pales in comparison to some of these new surgeries that we're able to do. Again, what Dr. Berkowitz is talking about, we're talking about a length of stay in a very invasive surgery that many of these patients weren't even a candidate for because they're so acutely ill, and now they're leaving the next day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is unbelievable what we were able to do now. And it's just, we have some of the best doctors in the world here. It's just so exciting. And that coupled with our anesthesia professionals just makes such a magnificent experience. So, yes, it's nice to have newly painted walls and new carpet, but honestly, it's the service that is really making the difference. And when we talk about new construction, it's just not making a nifty new room. These are much larger rooms, which really great technology to help and enhance communications and visualization, where you can just see things. If you speak to surgeons, they'll tell you they can just see things they were not able to see before and operate at a level of a specificity that is just very exciting. And so to see some of these enhancements here in the community, that no, you don't have to go to Mayo Clinic. No, you don't have to go to another state or even up to the city. We can do it right here and do it very, very well.
One of the things I've asked some of the other, even CEOs of the other healthcare systems in the past about, and I always like to check back with them on these things, is talking about the status of healthcare in Northwest Indiana. A lot of the conversation early on talked about the fact that the hospitals and clinics and other facilities here in Northwest Indiana have to compete with Chicago. You kind of mentioned that too about the fact, and we see, and not only that, we see now too that even operations like Rush have set up at least to some nearby
facilities. In fact, I think maybe here in Munster, even there's a facility. They're looking to be able to, I think, to maybe not expand as much as serve the people that maybe have come in for procedures in Chicago, and maybe to be taken care of closer to home because they're from here instead of having to drive all the way into the medical district in Chicago. Do you think that facilities like what's been set up here and the improvements here at the community hospital will, if not take away the need for having to, you mentioned about having to go out of town, but it's going to make it a lot easier for everybody?
I think it truly, you know, that's our purpose. I think we provide the quality of care where people can feel comfortable coming here and knowing that they get that, what people refer to as the, I'll use the air quotes, you know, that Chicago-type major medical center care. And I can tell you from the perspective that I was in academic practice for 12 years prior to coming here in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you now with great certainty that we provide the same, if not better, quality care here at our hospital and our medical care system, our medical system, than can be provided in Chicago. Okay. So there's really no reason for patients to go to the city unless they require specialty care such as transplantation services and things like that.
Okay. Do you think that with the improvements that are here at Community Hospital, that this maybe, at least from your point of view, gentlemen, that you feel that kind of sets the hospital up better when we have situations developing like the ongoing look into the merger of Methodist hospitals with the Franciscan Alliance? It's all business, I know, but they do it for a reason, too, I suppose, that they want to be able to take care of their patients. Do you think that this maybe will put Community Hospital and maybe on a little, maybe not necessarily a step ahead, but certainly a little higher up on the list, do you think?
I leave that business to the CEOs. What we do is this is just a continuation of our mission. Mm-hmm. And in the end, that's what it's about. If you're a mission-oriented organization, you're going to be successful. And that's what's so exciting. We have a partnership here that Dr. Berkowitz and I sort of encapsulate Community Hospital in that it takes both. It takes a very astute physicians and hardworking nursing staff and support staff. And so I'm a nursing director, and I coordinate a lot of that staff, and Dr. Berkowitz is a physician leader, and it really takes both of us to coordinate this kind of care, and that's really what Community Hospital does. And so with other organizations, I wish them success, but really we're just focused on today and taking care of the patients that come in. And like I said, it's just exciting to see some physicians that have been practicing for 20-some years who are so invigorated and so excited about the future. They're not just doing the way things they've always done it. They're very excited about the new research and new procedures coming out. So it's really exciting to be a part of it.
It probably helps the younger physicians, the ones that have maybe just come out of medical school off residency. They're actually getting to be full-fledged physicians. They probably have learned a lot of these newer techniques that you're offering here at the Community Hospital. And they probably feel, they come in, they probably feel much more at home. They probably feel also invigorated, as well as the veteran physicians too, I would imagine.
Yeah, I just want to point for a second to what John said, and we have an example. We had a vendor who we've used in our operating rooms, and the vendor had just come back from the Mayo Clinic, and his comment to me was, after seeing our new operating facility, he said, "You know what? Mayo Clinic has nothing on you guys as far as the facilities."
Yes, it's a wonderful compliment.
Right, it was really good to hear because a lot of people have invested a lot of time and effort and obviously money into making this, a top-notch medical center. And I think part of it too is being able to approach our administration, approach the board, and say, you know, this is the vision that we have, and it's sort of, they've inspired a shared vision with the entire system, and I think that that's what's really important. We've had to make some changes along the way as far as how we're going to approach reconstruction, but I think by the fall of this year, we should be pretty much complete with the entire project.
Dr. Richard Berkowitz is the Medical Director of Surgical Services, and John Olmsted is an RN who is the Director of Surgical Services, both with Community Hospital in Munster. The number of false distress calls made in the Great Lakes region has almost tripled from last year. Great Lakes Today's Elizabeth Miller reports that feigning emergencies can put others in danger.
Anyone there? Please, tell us. We're stuck and we're stranded. We're all tired, we're all hungry. Please come back. This was one of the more than 160 fake distress calls that the Coast Guard 9th District has received this year, compared to just 55 last year. Since the agency takes every call seriously, hoax calls can greatly deplete resources needed for real emergencies, according to the 9th District's Christopher Yaw.
If we think someone's in the water, that can launch a helicopter from one of our air stations. If it's something that's large enough, we could be launching Coast Guard cutters. Being that we have the shared border, that could even launch getting some Canadian assets involved.
The Coast Guard says helicopters could cost $16,000 an hour to operate, while boats run about $4,500 an hour. The Coast Guard says, on average, the response to a hoax call can last 3 hours before it's called off. People can face up to 6 years in prison and thousands of dollars in fines for knowingly making a false distress call. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Great Lakes Today is a journalism collaboration of public radio stations WBFO in Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Public Radio in Rochester. And for more stories, you can go to greatlakestoday.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.